Governor Holcomb unveils a teacher pay plan for next year, a new Republican candidate for attorney general, plus gubernatorial fundraising numbers and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 17th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb proposed a new plan to free up state dollars for teacher pay in his State of the State address. Republicans insist that further efforts to boost educator salaries must wait until the 2021 budget session. Holcomb's new plan, targeted for next year, would use one-time dollars to pay down part of a teacher pension fund.
In turn, $50 million a year will be generated to redirect to teacher pay.
But Holcomb wants to wait until 2021 to enact that plan, and Senate Democratic leader Tim Lannon questions why.
I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, right? No, pay me now. Let's get the money on the table.
Republicans are spending new money this session on cash payments for higher education capital projects approved in last year's budget. Was presenting this plan right now a good strategy for Governor Holcomb? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, does this send the right message to teachers?
Oh, come on. We are going to give you a raise that's less than $1,000, maybe in 2 years. That's the right message for teachers? I mean, all it does is project weakness, okay? We have the resources to do something, and he's not doing it. And, you know, there was nothing objectionable in the State of the State. It's just so small bore. I mean, I'm all for avoiding recidivism, but if we go from one person that doesn't go back to prison to five people from back that don't go back to prison, it really isn't that big a deal. If we've lowered the infant mortality rate to where we were in 2012 and we're still above the national average, that's not something you want to pat yourself on the back about. I mean, we have significant problems in this state, and the way we approach it is so incremental that it is almost non-existent in terms of progress. I mean, the three-year-olds who aren't getting preschool education now will probably be in the workforce before we fully implement it in Indiana. And healthcare costs and teacher salaries, all the things that affect a broad spectrum of the population, he avoided. And, you know, that's not leadership, okay? He's spending so much time patting himself on the back that he's not looking at what the problems are or proposing anything to fix them.
When it comes to the teachers' pay issue specifically, what Governor Holcomb is proposing could happen right now. They could do it if they wanted to. They're choosing not to, and they've laid out their reasons for doing so. But is it a good idea to tell teachers, we've got a plan, but you got to wait?
Yeah, I think it is, because I think it's prudent to make sure you work this in. We passed a budget last year. We increased education spending by $768 million, because there's a rally at the State House does not mean you go spend another $250 million. When you're already working on the problem, the multiple problems that were identified at that rally, two of which are being addressed directly in this legislative session, and a third teacher pay, which is now coming in a more enhanced way than it was before. And you could argue that everything that teachers came to the State House to protest in November in that large protest are either going to be addressed immediately or are being addressed over time. But look, I get the bottom line. When you open your paycheck, if it's not higher than it was last week, then it doesn't really matter what you said in the State of the State, which is why the governor and legislative leaders know they've got to do this. They have to get this right. They can't pay lip service to teacher pay for 2 years or for last session and this session. And teachers did see an increase this year directly because of the record increase in spending in K-12 education that came through in 2019. On the other items, it is meaningful that we have reversed the trend of infant mortality in the state. And the other things that Ann attacked, those are things that were not being addressed effectively before, and they are now.
You know, just 1 second here. Every budget that passes has a record increase in education funding.
I was wondering when you were going to call me on that.
Just
I haven't
for
seen
the record,
that,
okay?
Seen that for
and
months.
The bottom line is that record increase barely keeps set.
It was a record increase
the,
over the traditional increase,
right?
For sure.
And it was a barely increases above inflation. So don't keep talking about the record.
Well, I mean,
increase.
99% of teachers getting a raise that was beyond.
Well, we don't know that it's 99% of
no,
teachers.
No, we don't.
We know that it's 99% of
school districts.
Right,
John. Does Governor Holcomb, the Holcomb administration officials, in talking to reporters, describe this as a kind of down payment? It doesn't actually have money, but
it isn't actually
the
down.
The idea that we're telling teachers we are actively working on this. Here's one plan as part of what will be a larger plan to come.
I think that's what this is. This is a fancy, high profile way of saying, hey, in case there was any doubt, we still know that you're underpaid. And that you need to know we're going to do something about it. And I think part of that was forced. He was in a box of his own making to a certain extent because a couple of weeks ago or a week ago now, when in response to a question, you know, nobody expected him really to go much further down this path in the State Address. And a week prior, or just a few days, he kind of hinted there might be something. So then, you don't want to have the compounded problem of teachers who. You know, maybe we're starting to adjust to the notion that they could wait a year and then to have that carrot dangled in front of them, I think, odd. So this, it seems to me, was a reminder. You're going to get money. Here's one way to do it. And yet not go so far that you make the commission that you created to put together recommendations to solve the problem that's meeting and will not even come up with recommendations until summer feel... To go any further would have made them probably irrelevant, or at least feel irrelevant. So we had to walk that fine line.
But the governor promoting a plan for an idea for 2021 in the 2020 State of the State Address, is this the pressure we've seen from teachers bubbling
up? I think it
has
to be. I mean, that's a novel approach if I've ever seen one. Usually when you sit down for State of the State, it's here's things we want to do now. I've never before seen a governor say, hey, a year from now we should do this. So if that's not him feeling pressure, then I don't know what is.
Yeah. You know, Democrats did react to the State of the State, and they had amendments in committee this week that did address teacher pay. One of them was very similar to what the governor wanted to do, except it didn't pay off the pension obligation like the governor wants to do to free up $115 million on an ongoing basis. It just it just refinanced the debt.
Yeah.
And for less money. So, I mean, the structural approach isn't necessarily different between Democrats and Republicans. It's just the one that Eric Holcomb picked is far more effective.
The timing
except that
the
is different.
Timing is different.
Yeah.
They want to do it now as opposed to sometime in the future.
All right. Well, Indiana Department of Revenue Commissioner Adam Krupp announced this week he will seek the Republican nomination for Attorney General, challenging incumbent Curtis Hill, who's been accused of sexual misconduct by 5 women. Adam Krupp never mentioned Curtis Hill by name in his remarks, but he made plenty of references to the embattled Attorney General as he launched his run for the office. He emphasized the public trust and says the state's highest legal officer must, quote, abstain from an offensive personality, language directly from the ongoing attorney discipline case against Hill.
Without integrity and trust, the very core of any attorney's credibility, the attorney-client relationship is broken. When that relationship is broken, clients find new lawyers. It's time for Hoosiers to hire a new lawyer.
Krupp is resigning his state agency position to run for AG full-time. His first challenge is getting the Republican nomination at the state party convention in June. Indianapolis attorney John Westerkamp is also running for the GOP nomination. Mike O'Brien, can Adam Krupp beat Curtis Hill at the GOP convention?
I think he can. He's got the right blend of experience. He's been a practicing lawyer. He's licensed in 4 states to practice law. He's been tapped every time there's been some kind of major, many times when there's been a major project in state government, whether it was at the BMV or Department of Revenue, FSSA, he's been tapped, or in the governor's office, he's been tapped to do special projects like that throughout his time serving 3 governors in the state. And he understands politics. He knows the retail nature of this, on how to run for a convention, how to knock on delegates' doors. and work the state. And he's already been doing it.
He even said he's leaving the Department of Revenue because he wants to make this a full-time run.
Right.
So I asked Mike, will he beat Curtis Sullivan?
I don't think he will. I know that's wishful thinking on Mike's part. But you've got a three-way split. And then what you have is a devoted following within the Republican hardcore for Curtis Hill, no matter how many times he behaves in an inappropriate manner or lies about it. They're going to vote for him anyway. I think they're proud of the fact that they finally have an African-American in elective office in a statewide capacity. So they're not going to turn him away. He's going to have that measure of support. And on a three-way split, I don't think anybody can predict what will happen for sure. But he's going to have his supporters, and I'd be surprised if he's not the nominee.
Is Adam Krupp, she just mentioned we now have three candidates. How much is John Westerkamp and Adam Krupp helping Curtis Hill?
I think having one opponent is a normal thing. I do think Ann's right, statistically, just math-wise, that, you know, if you always have X number of people who want to vote for Curtis Hill, then you're just going to split those who want to vote against Curtis Hill. So I don't know if John Westerkamp is in this for the long haul. We'll see, I guess. I know they had some campaign finance filings this week. He raised, I think, $40,000 or $50,000. Curtis raised a lot more, obviously. But we'll start to see if he can compete. I mean, with Adam Krupp being, you know, out of a job, and he can literally full court press this. I mean, that's going to be hard to beat.
And yet,
does Curtis Hill have a job?
He does.
Oh, does he?
He's
I bet he's campaigning a lot.
And yet, we also keep hearing, even this week, there might be another candidate coming, If you're looking at Adam Krupp, who will probably have a lot of institutional backing within the Republican Party, does that say to you, if you're another candidate out there, all right, that's the field?
It does seem that there seems to be at least the establishment is coalescing around Krupp. I mean, that's pretty clear, which would disappoint me if I were a guy who'd been in this race for months trying to work this, but that's the reality of it. He's a known commodity in the case of Krupp, and he has something. Again, this comes down to the governor. For him to get, he's already articulated very publicly what he wants to see happen, and now it's just incumbent on him to make it happen behind the scenes. And I would say he's going to have to channel, say, Lyndon Johnson. He already has the cowboy boots and he already has the height. Now he just has to figure out how to.
Does he have the vocabulary?
We won't find out because it's going to all happen behind the scenes.
Yeah,
but what
right.
he needs to do, I mean, Lyndon Johnson knew how to make things happen by hook or crook, you know, horse trading, whatever it took. And that what I'm is guessing is going to be, if we could be flies on the proverbial wall, is what's going to happen to derail a Hill candidacy on the part of the governor.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, who will be the Republican nominee for Attorney General in 2020? Curtis Hill, Adam Krupp, or John Westerkamp, or maybe even someone else? Last week's question, who will be the Democratic nominee for governor in 2020? 25% of you say Woody Myers, 40% say Josh Owens, 35% still say someone else. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, candidates for governor this week filed their fundraising numbers from the second half of 2019, and Governor Holcomb is blowing the Democratic hopefuls out of the water. Holcomb brought in nearly $2 million from the last 6 months of 2019, leaving him with more than $7 million in his campaign war chest. The incumbent Republican's campaign says that's a record in available cash heading into a gubernatorial reelection year. Democrats were left in the dust. Former State Health Commissioner Woody Myers led the way on the Dem side with about $180,000, but he has just $1,900 in cash on hand. Tech entrepreneur Josh Owens raised $84,000 with $16,000 in available cash. Nikki Kelly, we knew, we've said on the show, that Holcomb obviously was always going to have an advantage, but this?
Yeah, I have to be honest. I knew he would post a big number, and he did. I was not surprised or shocked by that. He obviously has a great grassroots network. All the Republicans are behind him. I also thought, you know, because there were three Democrats, that it would spread it out and not look very good. But to have three Democrats, including Senator Eddie Melton, who dropped out recently,
because of fundraising troubles,
collectively, you know, raise $325,000 only, I mean, I think that was pretty shocking.
And more than that, I mean, when we talk about these numbers, having cash on hand is important. Like, we don't just report that for no reason. That's important because it's how you're going to hopefully pay for the things you need to do to win this election. Woody Myers raised the most money, though a chunk of it he loaned it to himself, and $1,900 in cash on hand.
Not a good thing for somebody seeking that office,
a statewide,
chief executive
yeah.
position in the state of Indiana. That's very bad news. I think Nikki's exactly right with this assessment. We expected there to be a lead, but nothing like this. And I think it's attributable largely to the fact that the governor is not a polar, unlike some of his predecessors and other governors around the country, is not hated. No. And the biggest way it seems to, and this is sort of paradoxical, but the best way for an opponent, somebody who wants the job to raise money, is to channel or focus electoral hatred, yeah. and I hate to use that word, but that's basically what it is, toward the incumbent. And
it's hard to
hate him because, again, we've talked on this show before, it's more of a good government, what is your tax dollar, what have they done for you lately, we're going to make things work. And it's hard for people to get up and say, throw the accountant out of the office. You know, it's just...
Yeah. So they do with Mitch.
The guy who hasn't done anything.
That's what they did with Mitch. I mean, it was just good. It was management.
Although Mitch was more polarizing.
He was more polarizing.
Oh, yeah.
He was a little more polarizing.
Well, yeah, because he had to go in and upend state government. Upend state government after 16 years of Democrats.
I don't know. Daylight savings time was definitely polarizing.
Toll road.
And I'm still waiting for that money that was supposed to come down to my lawn after he got daylight savings time. I haven't seen it.
Are we still talking about daylight savings time? Are you kidding?
Have you been at the state house? At the state house, they're still talking about daylight savings time.
The point is Swinebarn is a new talk.
In some ways, Woody Myers is the perfect Democratic candidate. He's got $1,900 in the bank and he's $62,000 in debt. But this is just the way he runs. He ran if he's running for Congress or mayor or governor or whatever. This is just how he does it. It's lackluster. He expects everyone to do everything else for him and just flock to him. And if you want to look for where all the prominent Democrat donors and traditional industries that are making big donations, look at Eric Holcomb's campaign finance report, because he's got more Democrats donating to him than Democrats do.
Is there any way to spin this as anything other than terrible news for Democrats?
If there is, you should tell me.
I've been brainstorming, but I got nothing for you.
Well, you know, you did have a three-way split, so there is that. And then in addition, those two candidates are in a position to write checks of substantial amounts to fund the campaign, too. So let's not ignore that possibility as well.
Woody Myers has never done that. That's always been like the thing that hangs behind him. He's never once done it.
It also doesn't sit well with voters, I think. I mean, the fact that they could self-finance.
But you do it first.
Tell that to Bart Peterson on his first election when his father put $1 million in the campaign. It really
are we
him.
Turning on our own now, aren't
no,
we?
No, I'm just saying. voters will say if they can pay for it themselves, they're not beholden to any of the special interests, and that's a positive thing.
Donald Trump.
Everybody touts the fact that they got how many donations from little ladies retirees and $10
increments. Where does that get them?
Okay. All I know is Holcomb, it's hard to hate him, sounds like a pretty good slogan. Democratic presidential candidates met for their final debate this week before the first presidential contest of the year. The actual debate lacked a lot of the fireworks many expected, particularly after a recent controversy over private comments Senator Bernie Sanders allegedly made to Senator Elizabeth Warren about a woman's chances at becoming president. Still, that issue yielded perhaps the most notable moment of the debate.
Can a woman beat Donald Trump? Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women, Amy and me.
Indiana's Pete Buttigieg was again pressed in this debate about his poor support in the African-American community. He touted his support among the black community in South Bend and noted recent endorsements from African-American leaders in Congress and in Iowa.
The reason I have the support I do is not because any voter thinks that I'm perfect. It's because of the work that we have done facing some of the toughest issues that communities can.
That's true. Yeah. John Schwanes, are you surprised at how relatively tame this debate was?
Not at all, really, because I think it's has to do with the way that the Iowa caucuses unfold. Unlike primary votes where people go and, you know, punch a chat or pull a lever or whatever people do, press a screen, whatever they do this day, in the caucuses you show up and you go literally stand in a, or sit, I guess, in a corner of the room. Yeah. And then people come and try to persuade you to maybe move over here. And if you're sitting alone or you see only two people here and there are 100 people over there, you say, well, I don't want to waste my vote. So by you, this is not the time to go and rip apart the people who, even if
because
you're not,
second choice votes are going to
be second choice
really
votes,
important.
Third choice second, votes may be important. So if you go in there, guns a blazing, and you've just blistered the field, how inclined are Democratic voters in the caucuses if you've just ridiculed their number one choice and they're going to move to you at the caucus there in the gymnasium of the school, you know, at the high school? They're going to say that I don't like that. SOB, I'm going to go somewhere else that they at least are civil.
Off the air, I ended the intro to this topic with, at long last, we have the first presidential contest finally here. Is that what this debate felt like a little? It's like, we just want to get to
I think
get
we're
to
starting to
votes.
Get debate fatigue. Yeah. I mean, we haven't had a single vote yet, and you know, and we're hearing a lot of repetitive stances. It's bound to happen. Nothing, they're not doing anything wrong, but, I mean, you know, they're running out of platform, and so if you just keep bringing up again and again, we're just starting to get that fatigue.
I want to ask about Pete Buttigieg's answer to that question, because it's perhaps the most one of the most important questions he continues to face in this bid to become the nominee, which is his support in the black community. First, I'll ask you, was that answer good enough?
It is a hard question for him to answer. You're asking him why people don't like him, okay? I mean, what do you say to that? Is it because I don't like them, or I'm gay, or whatever the answer is not going to be satisfactory. I think he's doing what he needs to do to reassure black voters that he's concerned about the issues, particularly the economic issues that affect them. He's put out that Douglas plan. It's detailed in what he wants to do. He's talked about the student loans. He's talked about all the issues that are important. The fact of the matter is Biden has a lot of African-American support and was able, as a result of that support, to basically marginalize both Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. So there is that element of it. But I think he has done an outstanding – Pete Buttigieg has done an outstanding job of representing himself and the state of Indiana. Everybody that looks at him and listens to him understands that he has knowledge about the questions. He's thought them through. He has a program that makes sense, that's middle of the road. And, you know, I think the future's pretty bright for him. We'll see what happens.
We might not talk about this presidential race on the Democratic side before Iowa. So let me ask you this as we kind of close out this topic, which is, what does Pete Buttigieg need to do in Iowa to keep going strong in this presidential contest?
I think he's got to win it. I mean, there's clearly strong candidates in place, but I think he's put himself in a position to win it. He's got field offices everywhere. He's outraged everybody, and he's had the money to invest on the ground, which is exactly how you win that state, by sitting in living rooms and knocking on doors, and he's got the people on the ground to do it.
I don't think he has to win. I think he has to place in the top three.
I think he has to beat Joe Biden. If Joe Biden beats him, they're fighting for that centrist candidate sort of role. So, well, we'll see.
We'll see.
Legislation is on the move in both chambers this week to raise the legal age to smoke and vape from 18 to 21.
The Senate bill differs slightly from its House counterpart. Both measures create harsher penalties on retailers who sell tobacco products to underage buyers, a concept which has widespread support, even from retailers themselves. But the House version makes it much easier for retailers to lose their licenses when they sell to underage buyers, while the Senate version dramatically increases fines, something some Republican senators balked at. Congress recently raised the smoking age to 21, so the state-level measures are focused more on enforcement, which is still left to the state.
Mike O'Brien, is there much question about whether these measures will pass?
No, I don't think so. The governor and legislative leaders announced they were going to do this before Congress actually passed that. Increased the age to 21, right? So in some ways it took the wind out of the sails politically or maybe from a messaging standpoint, but unless you have enforcement at the state level, this is never going to work. The federal law is never going to be as effective as it could be. So it's actually really important they still do it, even though politically
they could go for 22 instead of 21.
Because so much of the focus now is on enforcement, because that is the state's role, even with the federal law change, Does this seem like a silly argument that we should be going after retailers more? Or is it really that nitty-gritty detail of it?
I think it's the exact example of the small bore state of the state. If he wants to stop, and I think he should want to stop, vaping below 21 and cigarette smoking below 21, the way to do it is to tax and to make it cost prohibitive. We're going to spend a lot of time and a lot of resources trying to go around on the retail level, like the same way we do with alcohol and teenage drinking, and we're going to be about as effective.
All right. Well, finally, on the move in the House is a bill that would ban employers from implanting devices in their employees. And Delaney, would this ruin my plan of installing lie detector buzzers in your arms?
No, but it would have ruined mine. I was going to have a little zapper that we could use if we didn't like the question.
I agree
with Anne.
I don't support that plan at all.
Is somebody actually proposing to do this?
Well, employers are doing it.
Are employers doing this?
Yeah, there's a high-profile example in Wisconsin that your employee ID is actually injected in your hand.
So we haven't seen it in Indiana.
Just track their phone.
As long as you're carrying a cell phone, you're already being tracked.
All right, well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.